The provincial capitals were embellished with vast public buildings and linked together by an effective and rapid service of posts and caravans. The frontiers were secure and well garrisoned, the army loyal, efficient, and brave, the governors and ministers honest and forbearing. The empire stretched with equal strength and unimpaired control from the Cilician gates to Aden, and from Egypt to Central Asia. Christians, pagans, Jews, as well as Muslims were employed in the government service. Usurpers, rebellious generals, and false prophets seemed to have vanished from the Muslim dominions. Traffic and wealth had taken the place of revolution and famine. Pestilence and disease were met by imperial hospitals and government physicians. In government business, the rough-and-ready methods of Arabian administration had given place to a complicated system of divans, initiated partly from the Roman but chiefly taken from the Persian system of government. Posts, finance, privy seal, crown lands, justice, and military affairs were each administered by a separate bureau in the hands of ministers and officials. An army of clerks, scribes, writers, and accountants swarmed into these offices and gradually swept the whole power of the government into their own hands by separating the commander of the faithful from any direct intercourse with his subjects. The imperial palace and the entourage were equally based on Roman and Persian precedents. Eunuchs, closely veiled harems of women, guards, spies, go-betweens, jesters, poets, and dwarfs clustered around the person of the commander of the faithful, each in his degree endeavouring to gain the royal favour and indirectly distracting the royal mind from affairs of business and state. Meanwhile, the mercantile trade of the East poured gold into Baghdad and supplemented the other enormous stream of money derived from the contributions of plunder and loot dispatched to the capital by the commanders of the victorious raiding forces which harried Asia Minor, India, and Turkestan. The seemingly unending supply of Turkish slaves and Byzantine specie added to the richness of the revenues of Iraq, and combined with the vast commercial traffic of which Baghdad was the center, produced a large and powerful moneyed class composed of the sons of generals, officials, landed proprietors, royal favorites, merchants, and the like, who encouraged the arts, literature, philosophy, and poetry as the mood took them, building palaces for themselves, vying with each other in the luxury of their entertainments, suborning poets to sound their praises, dabbling in philosophy, supporting various schools of thought, endowing charities, and in fact behaving as the wealthy have always behaved in all ages. I have said that the Abbasid Empire in the days of Harun al-Rashid was weak and feeble to a degree, and perhaps the reader will consider this a foolish proposition when he takes into consideration that I've described the empire as orderly, the administration definite and settled, the army efficient, and wealth abundant. The reason I make the suggestion is that the Abbasid Empire had lost touch with everything original and vital in Islam and was constructed entirely by the reunion of the fragments of the empires Islam had destroyed. There was nothing in the empire which appealed to the higher instincts of the leaders of the people. The holy war had degenerated into a systematic acquisition of plunder. The caliph had become a luxurious emperor or king of kings. The administration had changed from a patriarchal system to a bureaucracy. The wealthier classes were rapidly losing all faith in the religion of the state. Speculative philosophy and high living were taking the place of Quranic orthodoxy and Arabian simplicity. The solitary bond which could have held the empire together, the sternness and plainness of the Muslim faith, was completely neglected by both the caliph and his advisers. Harun al-Rashid himself was a wine-bibber, and his palace was decorated with graven images of birds and beasts and men. For a moment we stand amazed at the greatness of the Abbasid dominion. Then, suddenly, we realize that it is but as a fair husk enclosing the dust and ashes of dead civilizations. Harun al-Rashid died in 1809. At his death, his great empire fell immediately into civil war and confusion. And the next great event of unusual importance in this region of the world comes 200 years later, when the Turks, under the chiefs of the great family of the Seljuks, poured southward out of Turkestan and not only conquered the empire of Baghdad, but Asia Minor also. Coming from the northeast as they did, they were able to outflank the great barrier of the Taurus Mountains, which had hitherto held back the Muslims. They were still much the same people as those of whom one, Chuang, gave us a glimpse 400 years earlier. But now they were Muslims, and Muslims of the primitive type, men whom Abu Bakr would have welcomed to Islam. They caused a great revival of vigor in Islam, and they turned the minds of the Muslim world once more in the direction of a religious war against Christendom. For there had been a sort of truce between these two great religions after the cessation of the Muslim advance and the decline of the Umayyads. Such warfare as had gone on between Christianity and Islam had been rather border bickering than sustained war. It became only a bitter fanatical struggle, again, in the 11th century. 8. But before we go on to tell of the Turks and the Crusaders, the great wars that began between Christendom and Islam, and which have left a quite insane intolerance between these great systems right down to the present time, it's necessary to give a little more attention to the intellectual life of the Arabic-speaking world, which was now spreading more and more widely over the regions which Hellenism had once dominated. For some generations before Muhammad, the Arab mind had been, as it were, smouldering. It had been producing poetry and much religious discussion. Under the stimulus of the national and racial successes, it presently blazed out with a brilliance second only to that of the Greeks during their best period. From a new angle and with a fresh vigor, it took up that systematic development of positive knowledge which the Greeks had begun and relinquished. It revived the human pursuit of science. If the Greek was the father, then the Arab was the foster father of the scientific method of dealing with reality, that's to say, by absolute frankness, the utmost simplicity of statement and explanation, exact record, and exhaustive criticism. Through the Arabs it was, and not by the Latin route, that the modern world received that gift of light and power. Their conquests brought the Arabs into contact with the Greek literary tradition, not at first directly, but through the Syrian translations of the Greek writers. The Nestorian Christians, the Christians to the east of Orthodoxy, seem to have been much more intelligent and active-minded than the court theologians of Byzantium, and at a much higher level of general education than the Latin-speaking Christians of the West. They'd been tolerated during the latter days of the Sassanids, and they were tolerated by Islam until the ascendancy of the Turks in the 11th century. They'd preserved much of the Hellenic medical science and had even added to it. In the Umayyad times, most of the physicians in the Caliph's dominions were Nestorians, and no doubt many learned Nestorians professed Islam without any serious compunction or any great change in their work and thoughts. They'd preserved much of Aristotle, both in Greek and in Syrian translations. They had a considerable mathematical literature. Their equipment makes the contemporary resources of St. Benedict or Cassiodorus seem very pitiful. To these Nestorian teachers came the fresh Arab mind out of the desert, keen and curious, and learnt much and improved upon its teachings.